Hello, hello, hello.
Hello, is it me you're looking for?
Welcome to another special edition of 31 Thoughts, the podcast. Jeff Merrick alongside Elliot Friedman. And this was a really special interview, and I'm glad we had a chance to talk to Ben Cooper before he got on a plane and made his way to Denmark to coach hockey again. Ben is a former video coach with Hockey Canada, video coach with the Florida Panthers, and video coach formerly of the Vancouver Canucks as well. He's now a head coach in Denmark, and he's a really interesting guy. We always talk about, you know, young up-and-comers, and we had Riley Armstrong on a while ago, and we talked about him last week and his work with Sean Day and the Maine Mariners of the ECHL. And Ben Cooper, Elliot, is another one of those people you're probably going to hear more from sooner than later. And a real, not just an up-and-comer, but like he's a real go-getter, passionate, all-in hockey guy.
A really good storyteller, too, as you'll hear from this interview. He's sort of been around a lot of big situations, and it's allowed him to accumulate knowledge and experience in high-pressure situations. And I think that really helps you. I first got to know Ben a couple of years ago. The coach's site has an annual conference in July, and a couple of years ago it was in Toronto. It's called the Team Snap Coaches Conference, and I went and I did one of the events for it, and I went and sat and listened to it, and it was really good. Like, there were a lot of really good guests and presenters. I remember Mark Crawford's daughter Katie, she went out and she was I think 25 or 26 at the time, and she talked about her studies, which were reaching millennials, and all of the coaches, no matter what age they were speaking to, came up after just to ask her more questions. But the presentations were really good. And then last year they had Peter DeBoer and Mike Kelly, who was an assistant coach in Vegas prior to Gerard Gallant getting fired. Mike was there with him, and they watched and talked about the Game 7 comeback for San Jose. And Craig Custance of The Athletic did the interviews, and it was riveting. And what they do is they put all these things online, and there's a membership for it, and it's the coach's site is the website, and they're going to do something in September this year, because obviously you can't do anything in July on two separate weekends. But if you're a member, you're allowed to go on site and look at any of the archive videos, and I've done that from time to time. I remember there was one game we were doing with Carolina, and they had a good penalty kill, and they had a Steve Smith breakdown of the Carolina penalty kill on there.
Oh, nice.
And I used it during a show. So that's how I got to know Ben, but his storytelling is excellent.
So enjoy it. I hope you do as much as we enjoyed talking to Ben, and we wish him the best coaching the Herning Blue Fox in Denmark. Here's Ben Cooper on 31 Thoughts, the podcast. Elliot, by the time our listeners hear this interview with Ben Cooper, he will be on a plane on his way to Denmark, where he's taking over the coaching responsibilities for the Herning Blue Fox. He's a former video coach of the Vancouver Canucks, former assistant coach with the Florida Panthers, Hockey Canada video coach as well. Ben joins us now. And Ben, for people listening to us right now, you're probably on a plane as this is entering their ears. What has the last 24 hours of your life been like?
Not too hectic, actually. I've had a lot of time off over the summer, two extra months, in fact. So I've had a lot of time to prepare, and basically just seeing a lot of family and friends and saying goodbye, and tiring my dog out so she's nice and relaxed for the nine-hour flight.
That's awesome.
All right. So, the dog's going with you?
Yeah. She goes everywhere.
What kind of dog?
She's a golden doodle.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Now, do you buy the dog a seat, or does she go in a kennel?
I wish she could fly next to me. No, she's. I don't think you can fly with him in the seat for intercontinental flights, so she'll be in the cargo hold in a crate.
Okay.
You see, Elliot, doesn't understand this because Elliot flies first class. So, Elliot, people like me stay in the back with the golden doodles while you're up stretching your legs in the front.
Actually, I got news for you. The golden doodles should be up front with me, and you should still be in the back. Okay, so Ben, there's a lot of places we want to go with you first, but you know, I think that when you do this, you go with the lead and you give the biggest story early. My favorite, in introducing you to a lot of our listeners, my favorite story about you is Team Canada, video coach, 2010, Vancouver, and what happened in the celebration after Sidney Crosby scored the golden goal.
Right. So we obviously all celebrated and we went out onto the ice. All the players were out there. The staff were on there. We're kind of on the bench. And then we jumped out to take the photo, the team celebration photo on the ice that is now an iconic team photo. And so after that photo was taken, we're sort of, you know, I'm walking back to the bench. Sidney approaches me and skates up next to me and he said, "Hey, Coop, can you, when we get back into the room, can you show me that, the goal again? Like, I don't remember what happened."
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, "What? What do you mean?" And he's like, "Yeah, I blocked out. I have no idea how I scored. I don't know if it was a rebound or what, how I shot, if I shot it or what happened." He literally had no idea. The moment was just so great and overwhelming that he just blocked out.
I find it really on brand that the first thing that Crosby would want to do is video work of his goal right after that thing goes in.
Yeah.
Like that, like honestly, that seems like a very Sidney Crosby story. While everybody's, you know, out there on the ice, and we think of the women with the champagne and the beer and the cigars on the ice and everything, everyone's having a great time, and Crosby wants to do video. Like it's a very Crosby story, is it not, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, he's just a student of the game always and just obsessed with getting better. So, I mean, he didn't really want to study it per se for a long period of time. He just more wanted to see, you know, quickly how he scored because he was curious, I guess, because he just had no idea. But yeah, he sure enough, we got into the room and I quickly showed it to him and he was like, "Huh, cool."
How would you break that down as a video coach? Because the way that I looked at that goal is, and I don't know, this is, must be just be instinct on Crosby's part. The minute that it seems as if Ryan Miller commits to the poke check, like his hand is going up the shaft of his stick, so he's committed to snap out the voodoo stick, that's when Crosby fires it in.
Yeah.
I don't even know if you asked Crosby if that was he was thinking and that's what he did, but it just seems like that's how you would break down the play. As an amateur video coach here, Ben, Jeff Merrick, yeah. That's how I would have read that. How would you read that?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't, I was so caught up in the moment too. Like I didn't really break it down either, but over the years, you know, as a coach, you focus so much on shooting the puck, just getting pucks to the net, pucks on, you know, it's such a cliche and you literally repeat it over and over at every level of hockey. It doesn't matter if it's peewee or NHL players, you say we have to shoot the puck more, shoot the puck more. And I remember 2 years ago with Florida, Paul McFarland, who's now with the Leafs and going to Kingston, he said, you know, release over location. Like, don't worry about where we're shooting the puck. Let's just, you know, get that quick release and just get it on net. So I think that's what he was focusing on, just getting the quick release before Ryan was set or had committed to a poke check. And, you know, thinking about that goal now, like we got a bunch of really cool video from the Olympic broadcasting channel or whatever. And there was like one where it was like no commentator noise. It was just the ice level noise. They had sort of like eliminated all the other noise and you could just hear the Iggy call for the pass. And that was the coolest thing that I heard, was just the ice level audio. And you can hear the urgency in the voice. You know, and I tell players like, "Hey, if you want the puck, like yell for it and communicate loud and use urgency in your voice." And you could really hear like Iggy. And so that stood out to me.
Let me have one final follow. I'm sorry, Alan, I'm hogging this, but I'm curious.
No, all good. All good.
What's more impressive to you, the pass or the shot?
Both. I think, you know, he doesn't get that shot off without the pass coming that quick. I think it was a backhand from the wall. Rafalski, I think it was, had committed up high on the wall and sort of left Sid alone. So it was a bit of a combination of the two, but just the two of them working together and communicating and the release. And yeah, it was just a magical moment.
That whole experience, I would just want to be around it to soak it up. Never mind just winning, although that's the most important thing. Mm-hmm. But just to see all those guys in that room, there's a lot of really talented people in there and all sorts of different jobs, a lot of alpha males there and all sorts of different works of life. And just what were your key takeaways? What are the things you remember the most when you think about that 2010 team?
Just how much poise there was and how relaxed and calm they were. Like, I remember, and I actually have, I had a little flip video camera, and I filmed a lot of stuff in the room, and no, there were no other cameras in the room during the Olympics the whole time. Like, there was no nothing. So I think I might be the only person that has any video of that room, you know, pregame speeches and during and after and stuff. So I watch it every now and then, and I've got a shot of one of the speeches. I think it's the pregame gold medal speech, and just to look at Scott Niedermayer sitting in his stall, he's just completely relaxed. He's just like, he's kind of, you know, slumped in his stall. He's just sitting there. He's just like, you know, ready to, you know, go for a walk at the beach or something. He was just so relaxed and not seemingly feeling the pressure. And the whole room was kind of like that. You just, you know, they had all won something at some point. I think one of the motivational videos that we did for the, you know, the beginning of the Olympics was, Babs is like, I want a video of everybody winning something. I want a shot of them, whether it was junior or NCAA or world championships or world juniors, every player I want to show them, you know, like raising a trophy or getting a gold medal or something. And I think the only one we couldn't find a video of winning, I think, was Duncan Keith, but he had won, I think, a Western Hockey League championship with Kelowna. But everybody else, we had video of them winning something. So there was so much experience in winning, and they were just so relaxed and calm. Even between the third period and overtime, you know, there was no panic. It wasn't very talkative. It was just, you know, kind of loose. Like, Joe Thornton was just like the most calming, relaxing presence there. It was amazing.
Now, I have to ask you, like, when this video was done, did everybody look at Duncan Keith and say, what exactly have you accomplished in your life?
No, I don't remember any talk about that. You know, he won the Stanley Cup later that year, so.
Yeah, he had a hell of a year. Those Blackhawk guys sure did.
Yeah, so maybe he was motivated by that, being left out. He won the Cup, so. Yeah.
Could have won the Conn Smythe, too. He was that good.
Yeah.
Two follow-ups come to mind out of that, Ben. Number one. Will you ever show that Niedermayer speech publicly? And number two, did Chris Pronger ever tell you to take that camera and shove it up your nose?
No, I should correct something. It wasn't, Niedermayer didn't have a speech. It was, you know, Babs's speech. But I was referring to Niedermayer just sort of sitting there, just being very relaxed and just the look on his face. But
still, I'd love to, people would love to see that, I bet.
Oh, yeah. I keep it. I'm not joking. I keep it on a flash drive in a safety deposit box with my two rings at a Royal Bank safety deposit box. So I've talked about a friend is like, you should do a documentary or something. And I thought about it in the 10-year anniversary. I think I'm going to wait to the 20-year anniversary. And I have shown it to some friends. I remember like a year after that, or the subsequent year of winning the Olympics, I showed it to a bunch of friends. And this is going to sound silly, but actually, Bain Pettinger, I was living with at the time, who's now an agent with CAA, you know, we'd watch it before we went to the bar, and we'd get fired up to go to the bar because it was such a great, fun speech that just got us excited and in a great mood. So it's pretty cool to watch.
That's awesome.
I can remember being in Calgary that summer for Team Canada orientation camp and being outside the Team Canada dressing room. And Mike Babcock is being scrummed. And for many people, including myself, it was the first time, and this might be the first time that it was used publicly, I don't know, the term 200-foot game came out of a coach's mouth. And it was Babcock. I can't remember who he was talking about, but he referenced blah, 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 blah. He plays a 200-foot game. And everybody in the media went, oh, wow, new buzz term. And then that just got, like, that note got plucked like a fiddle by everybody. He plays a 200-foot game, 200-foot game, 200-foot. It became, that's all anyone could say about, you know, two-way players. He plays a 200-foot game. What were the takeaways for you from working that? I'm curious about your relationship with other coaches as well, but with Mike Babcock, what were your takeaways working that closely with him?
Well, Babs and I sort of worked together a lot leading up to that camp, putting together the tech package, like the book that had our systems. And so we would be on the phone a lot, and I would be building it in PowerPoint, and you know, we had rink diagrams and, you know, arrows and words. And the thing that struck me the most was like the simplicity and the words, the language that he used. And he could, you know, he would invent words or terms, but you knew what they meant. He was really, really good at that. And so over the years, he's probably the best coach that I've worked with in terms of like a simple, easy to understand language. And I use some of the terms and words that I learned from him still to this day. And he's an extremely, extremely detailed coach. So I remember, you know, putting together that book and, you know, he would nitpick on the font size and the color of an arrow here and there. Like it was just every little detail was scrutinized. But yeah, I found it very educational to work with him during that time to learn about how he spoke with players. The other thing that struck me is the obsession that he had. And this is an important point for young coaches, all coaches, but the obsession he had with the amount of time that you had the player's attention in meetings, in team meetings, in video meetings. He was like obsessed with no more than 7 minutes. And I think it's over the years, I've heard that it's gone down. It's like 5.5 minutes or something now, where he's like, you cannot have a meeting literally longer than that time. That's all the focus you get out of the players. Like if you have 15 minute or 20 minute meetings like with video, like forget about it. They don't retain any of it, or, you know, small percentage. So that was a huge takeaway for me.
I'm curious about Mike as well. I remember talking to one of his ex assistant coaches who would talk about the homework that Babcock would give him. And one specifically said, you know, what Mike will do sometimes is he'll give us a scenario. He'll say, show up at the rink tomorrow morning with the answer as to why this decision is wrong. Mm-hmm. And he'll want everybody to arrive at that. Tell me why this is wrong. And that'll be like the homework for the night. What kind of homework did Babcock give you?
Well, a lot leading up to it in the months. I can't remember anything specific, but I mean, in a general sense, he would challenge all of his coaches all the time, players too. Like he's a hard guy to work for, no question. He makes you better and you might end up hating him at the end of it, but mm-hmm. he's gonna make you better. Like he challenges you all the time. He wants your opinion, but you better be able to back it up. Like if you have an idea and he says, okay, show me. And then you got to show him on video and prove why your way is the better way. He will change things from time to time. Like if you're able to convince him, it's not often, but he will give you the opportunity. Like I remember in between the third period and overtime of that gold medal game, and he asked, you know, each coach before he went into the room to deliver his little, you know, pre-overtime speech, he went around the room, and it's Jacques Lemaire, Lindy Ruff, Ken Hitchcock, and myself. And, you know, he asked each one of those three guys, and then me as well, anything to add. And I actually remember what I said. It was because I had done World Juniors in Saskatoon a couple months before. We lost that game in overtime. John Carlson scored the overtime winner. And if you remember the rush before that, there was a drop pass on the rush as they entered the zone, and then a shot. And then because of a drop pass, the high guy in the zone is taking the shot and the other two drivers are committed. So that one of the things that Willie Desjardins said that pre-overtime speech was no drop passes on the rush. And so that's what I said to Babs during that. He didn't repeat it, but you know, he will. And my point is like, he will listen to all the coaches, even me, who's like, I don't know anything. And Jacques Lemaire's got 11 cups or whatever. And so he'll listen to coaches and use their information. And he's just, yeah, so detailed.
Harry Neal used to always say, there's only two places you're not allowed to make drop passes: at home and on the road. Everywhere else, make drop passes. Sorry, Fritz, yeah. Go ahead.
I wanted to move to Denmark. So you mentioned you took over your first year last year in Denmark, and you had a really good team, mm-hmm. a team that had a chance to win the championship.
Yeah.
And then, of course, all this happened. And, you know, I first of all, Ben, do you have any concern about going back for year two? Because as it stands right now, Denmark is one of the few leagues that's going to try to start on time. Like, how do you feel about all this? And, you know, just can you take us through the craziness and the weirdness and the disappointment of the end of last year?
Yeah, last year we had a really good year. We started poorly. It was my first year, and you know, we had a couple key injuries. First preseason game, we lost two of our top six players for 5 weeks in the first exhibition game, and then, you know, we weren't scoring and getting a lot of chances, but not scoring. Goaltending wasn't great. So anyway, we struggled for the first 2 months, and then we started to heat up. And by January, we ripped off 9 wins in a row, and we had the best record from November onward, and we finished in second place. And we played our last 2 regular season games with no fans because it was COVID was coming. And you know, at that time, we thought, oh, okay, well, they're going to postpone the playoffs for a few weeks, and this will cool down, and then we'll resume playoffs with maybe, you know, half fans or something. And so, so we played those last 2 games with no fans in our home building, and we won 7-3 and 10-1. The last game of the season was against the top team. So we were the second best team. They were the top team. They were coached by Garth Murray, Western Leaguer, former NHL guy. And we beat them. It was on national television. We beat them 10-1. So we had talked before that game and said, hey, like, there is a very real possibility that the season gets canceled. And, you know, we had our leading goal scorer had planned to retire at the end of the year. So we're like, you know, we just set it straight up as a staff, like, hey, this could be the last time we're all together in this room. And this is the last, this could be the last time we ever play together again. So, you know, we're playing the best team in the league. We're the second best. Let's send a message. And we thought the other team would be a little bit thrown off by no fans and maybe the playoff. And we were right. They were not focused. So we won that game, and we were obviously very disappointed in the playoffs getting canceled, but we understood why. And then I was on a plane a couple of days later home. So yeah, so excited to get back there. And Denmark as a country has done very well with COVID. I think they've had around 14,000 total cases and have about 400 active cases. But from what I understand, their life is very, very much back to normal, and they've dealt with it well. So,
like, what's the rules when you get back into the country? Are you in lockdown for 2 weeks and stuff like that?
No, actually. The EU has allowed, I think there's a list of 10 countries that if you go there, you don't have to quarantine. Canada's one of those countries. Mm-hmm. It's all based on numbers per capita or something. So I don't have to. They test you in the airport, and then you get your results within one or two days. So I guess maybe you quarantine for those 1 or 2 days. But that's, yeah, it sounds... sounds pretty normal. If I was to come home back to Canada, I'd have to quarantine for 2 weeks. So once I get there, it'll be fairly normal, it sounds like.
Ben, is there going to be anything you're going to do differently because of everything that we've just been through?
Other than to talk about the obvious, which is, hey, let's make sure we're not in big crowds when we're out. Let's wash our hands, you know, that sort of stuff. Like, it seems stupid, but just remind guys all the time that we need to do that. We have at our club there, you know, they have the entire youth club in the building as well, and we have a really nice gym. So a lot of the, you know, under 15, under 17, under 13, all those teams are using our gym a lot of the times in early morning. So we might limit that and tighten things up a little bit. But no, other than that, like, it seems fairly normal there. Like, they had the soccer championship a few weeks back, and they had 12,000 fans, which is less than they would normally have, but they had 12,000 fans at a sporting event. So that's a good sign. So as far as I know, they might have some rules in place for fans spacing or something, but I'm not exactly sure. But it sounds pretty normal. The only thing I'm worried about is sort of when cold and flu season comes around.
Yeah.
Is there going to be a second wave? So Denmark's fine. Like, they've dealt with it. They test really well and stuff like that. Medical system there is great. They, you know, the government communicates well. Everybody does what the government says. They'll trust their politicians there very much. So the only thing I'm worried about is, like, the borders. If, get, you know, people start going to Spain or going on ski trips in January and come back, that's when I'm worried. So I hope they just close the border.
Well, then, you know what? You know what, Ben? There's only one solution. You've got to be like Tikhonov and not let them go on vacations.
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, they loved it last year because I'm like, hey, I need a break too. Let's 6 days. I don't want to see you guys. I don't care where you go. Yeah, I'll see you in 6 days. And so everybody went off and went to Rome I went skiing in Garmisch, Germany. And yeah, so I don't know how that'll work, but we'll see.
Now, you, what's it like coaching there? I mean, obviously it's not the same as Canada, but as you talked about before, there are obviously fierce rivalries, which are important to the players. What's it like coaching in Denmark?
To be honest, I loved it. I loved every aspect of it. It was such a great experience. It's a really nice country, good people. Everybody speaks English, so there's no language barrier. The hockey was really good. It was better than I thought. The Danish players are better than I thought they would be. They're really humble, hardworking, good people. They want to win. They're not in it for the money or fame or anything like that. It's a small league, small country, and so they really worked hard. One thing with our team, it's a very unique thing in hockey is that about 85% of our players, or 80% of our players, are from our town. They're born and raised in Herning, which is, I don't know when you ever get that in pro hockey anywhere. So there's a ton of pride amongst the guys on the team. They grew up in that club and grew up in the town. And the club has won the most championships in the league's history. And it's a small town, like 50,000 people in the middle of the country, but they've produced four NHL players. Freddie Anderson, Nick Jensen, who was a Canucks first round pick, mm-hmm. now plays in Jokerit in the KHL. Peter Regan was in Ottawa. And
Lars Eller?
Yeah. No, he's from Copenhagen. The last one is Franz Nielsen. So four NHLers from this town, and Franz Nielsen's brother is our goalie, and Freddie Anderson's dad is our goalie coach, and Nick Jensen's dad, Dan Jensen, is my assistant coach, and he played in the OHL, born and raised in Toronto, moved over there when he was 21 and never came back, had two kids. Yeah, so it's a really cool setup we've got there. Got a really good, young, ambitious GM who I work really well together with, and I think the players really liked the systems that I brought and the detail and the video and the hard work. And I think we had fun. We competed really hard, and I think it was the players liked the experience, and so did I. So I'm excited to get back and do it again and win this time.
Who's your video coach?
I am. actually, we have a part-time video coach, but yeah. To be honest, like, I'm so fast at it now. And it would take so much more time to train somebody. It's just like, I'll just do it myself. And I'm over there single, like, you know, I just have the dog. So I have no life. I just go to the rink. I come home. I go to the gym. I go for a walk. I cook dinner. And then I just watch video all from my dining room table. I just have the TV on in the background, run some Sportsnet highlights or whatever in the background, and just watch video, break down our games and pre-scout other teams. That's all I do. And so I'm just grinding all the time. And I do that for 8-9 months, and then I come home and live in Kitsilano and go to the beach every day.
It's good life.
The off season. So yeah, it's not bad.
Pretty good. Wow.
Figured out. Yeah. So.
So of those four, Jensen, Nielsen, Regan, and Anderson.
Yeah.
If there was a favorite, like if you were to talk about like who was the favorite Danish player from your region who played in North America, who would it be?
Probably Freddie, because he's probably the best one at the moment. That's a good question. They're all heroes there, honestly. Like the fans love them. And any one of them. And then, you know, you go to the club in Copenhagen. There's three clubs in Copenhagen, but one of them is Rotover. Apologize if I pronounced that incorrectly, but that's the home club of Lars Eller, Yannick Hansen, and Michael Bodker. Mm. So that's another really good club. So it depends on the region you're in, I guess, in the country. But for ours, you know, all four of those guys are real heroes. And there's some other guys too that, you know, we just signed a guy named Mads Christensen, who born and raised in Herning, and he was a really good player, national team player, went off to the German league and played 8 years in the DEL and won 6 championships, I think, with Berlin and Munich. And now we signed him to come back. And so he's a huge hometown hero too. So even guys you've never heard of are, you know, like gods over there. So
big guys, yeah. Big guys. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
I know that soccer is huge in Denmark. Badminton also is enormous there for, I have no idea why, but for some reason, badminton is huge there. Where does hockey rank on that, you know, sports hierarchy?
Yeah, soccer for sure is number one. Handball's probably number two.
Oh, yeah.
And then, yeah, they like their racket sports. I think I looked it up actually last year, popularity. For team sports, it's probably third for overall sports, maybe like 6 or 7, because I think, yeah, some of those individual sports, racket sports and what have you, are 4, 5, and 6. But yeah, it's probably third most popular team sport there.
You were in Florida before with the Panthers before you went to Denmark. First of all, mm-hmm. you know, how did you end up in Denmark? How did they find you?
Yeah, good question. So the day after the season ended in the 18-19 season, myself, Bob Bugner, Paul McFarland were all let go. Jack Capuano was offered a different position and chose to leave. So the four of us were out of there and met with Dale Tallon that, you know, the day after he let me go. It was very brief, but one of the things he said to me is he said, sounds like you want to be a head coach, so why don't you go do that? And I said, you're right, I will. And I had been a video coach since, or an assistant coach or some form of video coach since 2005. And so I was ready, and I was under contract for another year. So I was getting paid regardless. So I could have sat around and done nothing. At the very least, I was going to be an assistant coach at UBC, volunteer assistant coach for Sven Butenschon. And I talked about that because that's right in my backyard here where I live, and just to, you know, do something and still get paid by Florida. But I had a friend that worked in the French league, Brendan Sonny. He's a young coach and played in the Western League. And he was a head coach in France, and he loved it. And he told me, hey, there's a job in Chamonix, France, right in the Alps. You know,
oh, beautiful, beautiful yeah. city. Beautiful yeah. city.
Beautiful spot. I think they had the Winter Olympics way back, you know, 100 years ago or something. And so it would have been a really cool experience. So anyway, I was all over that. I thought, well, that'd be fun. So I interviewed. I thought I was going to get the job. I ended up not getting it. And in that time, I had really thought about coaching in Europe. I'd put a lot of thought to it. I was getting really excited about it. So I was like, when I didn't get the job, I said, okay, that's it. I'm going to find a way. So I made a list of all the European connections I had, and I was going to call and email all of them and see what jobs they knew about. And I think like the first or second guy that I had on my list that I called was Yannick Hansen, who I knew from Vancouver. We had a good relationship. And so I called him up. He answered on the second ring, and he was dropping off his kids at school. And I said, hey, Yannick, do you know any jobs open in the Danish league? And he said, yeah, I do. There's one in Herning. And I know the GM there. He's a young, ambitious guy. And here's his email address. So I emailed him, and Marty, who is our GM, must have been in front of his computer, because he wrote back within 3 minutes to my email. And his answer was, this is amazing. We are looking for a young, ambitious North American coach. I said, well, that's me. So I was on a plane to Denmark like a week later from Miami or from Fort Lauderdale. And then I was hired 2 weeks later. So I think I was unemployed for like 20 days or something. So
this is a great story. I'm curious about in Florida. And listen, we all know that Paul McFarland deserves a lot of credit for this as well. But that power play was dynamic.
Yeah.
What made that thing work, and how tightly did you work with McFarland on it?
Not that tight. I mean, that was his own baby. Paul's a super hardworking, really intelligent, detailed coach. I've never seen that amount of detail with a power play. And in that situation, it worked. They just had the right personnel and the right, you know, I mean, so much skill with, you know, you had Yandel, you had Barkov, you had Huberto, Dadonov, and just so much skill. And he implemented a few details to that really helped. And he had a lot of detail to it, and it worked in different breakouts for different, you know, penalty kill forechecks and all kinds of stuff. And I've worked with other coaches where, you know, like Glenn Gullitson, who coaches the Oilers power play, he gives them a bit of framework, but he's like, just give them a bit of framework and tweak things here and there. But other than that, just get out of the way and let them go. And that worked equally as well too. So I've seen it both ways, where you're incredibly detailed and fine tune everything, constantly obsess over every little detail, and it's successful. But I've also seen the other side of it, where you have so much skill, you just sort of give them a little bit and just get out of the way and let that skill and creativity take over on the power play. Penalty kill is different. I think you can be way more structured, but power play, I think it works both ways. So in our situation in Florida, it was incredible. It worked really well.
How much of that Florida power play was, and again, you know, Nashville did this, but really didn't find much success. It's sort of not really done anymore, but how much of it was bombs from the point?
I mean, Yandel, who was at the top, doesn't really have a bomb, but he's so, so creative and so smart and can get pucks through and can thread the needle. So it wasn't really needed. And then I'm trying to think who is, you had on the flanks, I think it was.
Was Hoffman on that power play?
Yeah, so that's right. Hoffman and Huberto. So the threat of those two guys, like to me, the power plays that are the most dangerous are the ones that have great shooters on both sides. I mean, you need the bumper in the middle who can dish and who can tip and recover pucks. And same with the net front guy who can tip and is willing to stand in front and recover pucks and make passes down low. But to me, the ones that are the most difficult are the ones with the bombs from the flank, not necessarily the ones from the top, but like if you look at Tampa's, you know, they always had two, you know, Stamkos and Kucherov. Those guys could both like just hammer the puck from both flanks. So like, how do you defend that? Like, you know, because as a penalty kill unit, sometimes if you had one guy that would shoot so hard, you would sit a guy on him. So, you know, like Weber, you know, Ovechkin, you just kind of sit a penalty killer on him. But if you have two guys in the flank that can really shoot, it's almost impossible to stop.
And, you know, what are your goals, Ben? Ultimately, what do you want to do?
Well, I don't have a plan, you know, too far down the road. I'm really enjoying what
I can empathize with that. Yeah. I've always been like that. Like, I had no idea what I'm going to be doing in 10 minutes, never mind 2 years.
And who knows where this, you know, COVID world is going to take us. So right now I'm super thankful that I have a job in a good league in a really good country that's starting on time and just a really good situation. So I'm super happy there. I really enjoy being a head coach. I tell people this all the time when they ask me that, like, I'd be very happy if I had a 25-year head coaching career in Europe and I just work my way up and, you know, find myself working in the Swiss league and, you know, having a great life. I know other Canadians that have done that, you know, Sean Simpson, you know, just coached all over, a guy like that.
Yeah.
You know, I'd be over the moon to be, you know, working with the Seattle Kraken in 2 years. Like, that would be, you know, a dream come true too, because I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. And so back in the NHL or, you know, a head coach in Major Junior or, you know, a coach in the American League, I don't know. In 20 years, I'd love to be a head coach in the NHL or sooner. But if it doesn't work out that way, I'd be just as happy being a coach in Europe too. And who knows, you know, you 1 minute you're a hot young guy and you won a championship or whatever, and then the next minute you're old news and you don't have a job, and there's so many good coaches out there. So who knows? I'm just happy to, you know, focus on the process. I tell that to my players all the time. We focus on the process. We don't focus on the end result. That sort of happens if you focus on the process and do that well. So that's what I'm just trying to win with this team and enjoy the process and the experience, and then we'll see where it goes.
You've got a great perspective, Ben. And the one thing I'm thinking about as I'm hearing you talk about, you know, your life and, hey, man, if I can end up here or end up here, what's the old saying? Use hockey, don't let hockey use you.
Yeah.
Like, it seems like that's the life you're living. Like, you're using hockey in order to have great experiences, meet wonderful people, learn, grow, all these things.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to tell another story from the Olympics, and this is something that I tell people from time to time, and I just carry it with me wherever I go in hockey, and it just gives me the greatest perspective. And it's Steve Yzerman was the GM, of course, of the Olympic team. And when we were in Saskatoon for World Juniors a couple of months before the Olympics, he was there hanging around with the Hockey Canada people, and that's when they were announcing the team. Here's the roster of the Olympic team for 2010. They did it in Saskatoon around the World Junior time. And so the team was announced, and of course it was on the front page of the Saskatoon Herald, and it was big news. So Steve saved that newspaper, and I didn't understand why until later. So here we are in the Olympic Village the night before the gold medal game, and we're having our team meeting. We go through, I think it was a power play we did the night before or something, and had a little, you know, team meeting. It was very relaxed, and Babs did his thing, and then Steve said, I want to say something here, you know, and he hardly spoke. I think he spoke at the beginning of the Olympics, and he was very low key and just a great guy, and so he pulls out that newspaper that he had from Saskatoon, and he holds it up, and he says, "So everybody wants us to win this game. We know how much is at stake here. This is the biggest moment in Canadian hockey history. We know how much pressure is on us. But I saved this newspaper," and he held it up. And in the bottom corner of the front page of that paper was a tiny little headline, and it said, "Four Canadian soldiers killed in Afghanistan," or something like that.
Hmm.
And he said, "Everybody wants us to win this game, but just remember, this is not life and death, right? We're playing a game. We're very lucky to do so. you know, these guys, these soldiers, you know, that's life and death. They give their lives, and you know, we're lucky to just play a game. So when you're out there tomorrow, just, you know, keep that in mind. Just have fun, enjoy the moment, enjoy the process, and don't put too much pressure on yourself. Just have some perspective. So I was like, yeah. And I could feel the room just sort of like, just be a little bit more relaxed and just, you know, have fun with it instead of feeling the pressure. And so wherever I go, whatever I do now, I'm like, yeah, it's just a game. You know, yeah, we take losses hard and stuff like that, but just a game, you know?
That's great perspective. And what a wonderful story to end on as well. And you're a great story as well. Listen, you got a pretty cool life. Hockey, dogs, Denmark, Kit Solano.
Yeah.
Like, Ben, you kind of got it figured out here.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy. I mean, I do feel a little bit of guilt at some point when my mother says, you should, you know, I think you need a wife and kids. And all the people, all my friends my age have two kids at this point, and I'm like a little bit, you know, like maybe I should get on to that. I will eventually, but for right now, I'm 43, and yeah, it's pretty great life right now, so we'll see how it goes.
Hey, you make me feel good, Ben. I didn't get married till I was 39, and my family was all over me too. I'm gonna say, this guy, he makes me look like Ben Johnson compared to that, or Usain Bolt, or Donovan Bailey.
This has been a lot of fun. Ben, thanks so much. Best of luck. Safe travels. Good luck with the squad this year.
Thanks, guys. My pleasure.
That's Ben Cooper, head coach of the Herning Blue Fox in Denmark. We wish him the best. And Elliot, I don't know about you, but man, would I love to see that 2010 video.
Unbelievable.
Like, doesn't he owe it to hockey?
Yes.
Like, if you're anyone at the Hockey Hall of Fame listening right now, even if it's embargoed, like, don't you want to have that copy ready to unleash to the world of hockey at some point?
Absolutely. I want to see Niedermeyer basically clipping his nails while Babcock's rallying them up.
Those are some great stories. We wish Ben all the best. Just a wonderful guy, and really enjoyed that conversation. And hope you enjoyed the bonus podcast this weekend. Elliot, any final thought on what we just heard from Ben?
You know what? I would love to go see some games in some of these smaller European cities and hockey markets.
Yes.
Like, listening to him to talk about hockey in Denmark, I'd want to go.
If I was independently wealthy, I would love just to park a year and go and do that one winter. Just travel.
I've heard that you are independently wealthy.
No, my money makes noise in my jeans. It's not like that long, quiet green that you have.
Yeah, sure.
Mine still rattles around in my pockets as I walk. I would love to do that, Elliot. Just like to that point, like go to like the most obscure places to find hockey. And small towns. Just a take one. Great way to see the world. And again, to the point that we talked about with Ben, use hockey. Don't let hockey use you.
Agree.
Those are some great stories. Really great stories by Ben. Okay, this podcast returns on Thursday. Hope you enjoyed our interview with Ben Cooper. And we always love bringing some non-familiar names to your ears. And we hope you enjoyed the interview here with Ben in that spirit. On behalf of Elliot Friedman and our producer, Amal Delich, we thank you for listening today. We're back Thursday with another edition of 31 Thoughts, the podcast.